You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Staff, I welcome you all to the Columbia University School of Social Work. We are greatly honored tonight with another fascinating panel on important human rights and social justice issues, often addressed by our faculty, by our students, by our alumni, and also through a very, very important joint partnership between OSI and the Columbia University School of Social Work. OSI's Documentary Photography Initiative highlights the important role photographers, activists, social workers, policymakers have in moving towards tangible change and for a better and more just world. This exhibit harkens back to me to, though it's, you see pictures in Paraguay and Mexico, and there are also pictures that could be reminiscent of things that happened in the United States. And we welcome Eugene Richards, Sue Mycelis, Eric Rosenthal, and others who were involved in this project. We hope that you enjoy your visit to our school and you take the opportunity to view this exhibit on the fourth floor and bear witness to the tragedy that occurs to those who are mentally ill and with disability around the world. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Amy Yenkin, Director of the Documentary Photography Project at the Open Society Institute.
Thanks, David. I want to say a thank you to David, because a couple years ago I got a call from Wendy Foyer, who's the curator for this building that was going to be built for the Columbia School of Social Work, and she told me that David Yam had been at OSI's offices because he sits on the selection committee for us and saw these photographs, and wouldn't it be wonderful to bring these to the Columbia School of Social Work? And it is wonderful, and that was the beginning of this relationship, so I want to thank you, David, for that. I do want to welcome you here. This evening, Photography as Advocacy, is a part of a series that's connected with the Open Society Institute's Moving Walls exhibition. We have a Photography as Advocacy as a question because we want to talk with photographers and organizations and explore partnerships and explore whether or not photography can be used to bring about social change. So this is part of an ongoing conversation this evening. I welcome you back if you've been here before. We also host these events at our offices at 59th and 9th, where we have an exhibition, and I welcome you to come there as well. I have the pleasure of introducing Susan Mycelis, who since 1997 has been the curator of our Moving Walls exhibition and is the moderator for tonight's panel. Susan Mycelis joined Magnum Photos in 1976. She's the author and editor of several books, and her coverage of the insurrections in Central America and human rights abuses have been widely published throughout the world. In 1997, Susan completed a six-year project on a visual history of Kurdistan and established a website for further inquiry. In 2003, Susan published Encounters with the Dani. Susan? Do you want to sit down?
In the hopes of keeping this informal and to the point, I think you all have a paper which announces who we are going to be listening to and interacting with. I just want to say that obviously Gene Richards should not be a stranger to anyone in this room. His work has been outstanding and pioneering and keeps the beacon light beaming as best it can in a very difficult environment for at least 35 years. And Eric, who began the Mental Disabilities Rights International Group 12, 13 years ago, I think we all just want to hear from. So we're going to begin with Gene presenting the work, in case some of you have seen the exhibit. The DVD he's going to present is a bit different, and I think then we'll really get into the dialogue. So thank you, Gene and Eric, for taking time to be with us. Thanks.
Hi, it's nice to be here. It's a little nerve-wracking also to be up in front of a group like this, but it's a pleasure because I had the opportunity, the work that we do, that I do through ERIC and Mental Disability Rights International, is very hard to get out. So when OSI gave us the opportunity to have this show, it was really profoundly wonderful, and to have a little show here, and also to be showing it to people who have kind of like-minded directions is especially wonderful. And to be on a panel here with Susan, with her life's work, and ERIC, is also makes it a little easier, because I'm not in the company of strangers. What I wanted to begin with is we had kind of series of accidents. We have some people here we put through the loops a little bit, like Whitney from OSI, simply because we were going to make a little tiny film to show you the conditions of the last trip that we made, the last couple of trips, which is to Paraguay, the neuropsychiatric hospital in Asunción, Paraguay. And in that place, and you'll see some of these photos, I'll explain what you're going to be seeing. Among the startling sights, for me at least, is I think ERIC reported, other people reported, that there were a couple of young boys in this institute that we were going to go into. It was supposition. We had heard the rumor that these boys had been kept in locked cells, 6x9 cells, for 6 years. Little cells with the toilet and the floor kind of thing, not lit, not heated. They were basically naked in these cells. So we came into this place and thinking we'd have to look for them, there they were. And simply put, there they were. And later ERIC can explain some of the work that he's been doing, because that's really what it's all about, to change the situation in this place as he changed in his organization, changed situations in other institutions like the one in Mexico. To begin with, I'll show you a kind of a slideshow of what Paraguay is like. And in the sound that I'm going to play, it's very crude, because like I said, we tried to put something together for you. Each time that I went into the institution in Paraguay, someone came up to me and started singing. And they wanted to sing their songs, their repertoire. It was a woman who did, which I'll tell you an anecdote very quickly, because it's one of my favorite of all time. Is everybody, once this woman started singing the song, people came up to me and said, don't let her, don't bother you. She's too far gone. She's not important. She can't, you know. So I actually had a tape recorder and I taped her songs. When it was all over, after she followed me around for an hour, I wanted to give her something, a gift or something like that, and I had a Timex watch, and she pointed at the watch, and so I gave her my watch. And as we came to the car, as it was over, she came up to me, and she asked, not to me because I can't speak Spanish, but she asked someone how long the batteries were going to last. So I'm just thinking that it speaks to the nature of the people, and ERIC can tell you more, that many of these people have all massive ranges of disabilities. Some of them as simple as being, I think as we found out, abused by your husband. Alcoholics are there, people with MS are there, along with the mentally ill and the mentally disabled. So many of these institutions are catch-alls for all kinds of people. So I think you probably know this. So I'll play you the slideshow, and then we'll try to let you listen to the singing of one of the men, because I thought it was very, to me, it's very poignant. And the person who's going to help me run this, is she helps me run my life, is my mate and partner and best friend, Janine. And Janine is the person, we show you a film here, that was the editor on the little film. I can tell someone how to do something, but I'm not technically equipped to do anything myself, and including running this equipment. So if you come up and get this going, this is Janine. Sorry, it's a little bit of feet. There are some things that you might want to know about some of the individuals. I mentioned a little bit of the story of the young man you can see behind bars there. One of the things that kind of, I remember that ERIC can talk to you about more of what he's up against than his work. The last day we were there, we were in this institution. It was actually for a couple of hours, I think three times. Our work has to be done very quickly. And at the end of, I didn't even probably tell ERIC this, at the end of our time here, I went to see the administrator because they called me into a room and said that we wanted you to know that all these people have been through, and I think maybe ERIC and his staff have examined the institution. What he does in his work is he does his video work himself, but basically he examines the medical records, the treatment schedules, the prognosis, where people go. I mean, his studies is pretty extensive. but she wanted me to say that you really have to do something very positive about this place. She says, go back and take another look. So I did. And I went back, and the first person I met was the woman at the end with her hands up, whose eyes had been plucked out by a patient. I think it was a matter of a few weeks ago, and there she was. And the patient, so you'll know what the patients are up against. While I was photographing, a woman came up to me, and a very tiny woman, and she grabbed my eyes, and I realized that she was going to pull my eyes out. And yet there she was, I mean, in amongst the population every day, and I started thinking what it means to live in a place like that, no matter what condition, in fear of being maimed any moment, and that's just one of the things that you could see. And later we can talk about the nature of the individual cases. What I'm going to show you next is a video. It's about 6 minutes long, and it was the result of my first trip with Eric. It was an assignment for the New York Times, and it was in Hidalgo, on Carranza, Hidalgo, Mexico, an institution called El Carranza, where we snuck in, split off from each other. I made photographs while Eric proceeded to probably harass the staff into trying to tell them something about the conditions there. The room that I went into had 100 people. It was 48 degrees, I believe it was. The people were basically unclothed. They were taking ice-cold showers, as you'll see from the piece. The reason I made this video might interest people is I was lucky enough, I got a little grant from the Jimmy Carter Foundation, and I went down there, and their seminar, which is not like unlike ours, for the couple of days that I was there, was a discussion of the proper terminology. What can you call people who are mentally disabled or mentally ill, and what you can't call them? And so I had just come back from Mexico, and somehow I understood this because language is very important, and how we acknowledge everything in terms of gender and race and conditions of people. But there are also the conditions themselves to encounter. And so we made this little video and I brought it back to the Jimmy Carter people, not to be a wise guy, to simply say that's very important, but there are also people who are suffering great, very real things that you have to also address. And so what I'm going to show you here is just an experiential kind of look at this institution.
So it's hard to shift out of the intensity of and the presence of the DVD, but I'm trying to think about if we can reconstruct a bit the process, because I think many people here are going to work through questions of production, dissemination, effectiveness. I think we want to go through that gamut in the time that we have, and then we'll start a conversation here and then invite you all to redirect in whatever ways you're most interested. I mean, I feel it's inevitable we have to ask, did this begin with an assignment, literally from the New York Times, and they linked the two of you? Because that seems almost magical that they were so... I mean, that's in the world that we live in today, of those of us who work in the media, that's a kind of striking beginning, though obviously the voyage has been much longer than what launched there. But is that, how did the story come to be initially, the partnership that came to be?
Well, I can say what was amazing about it is we've worked with a lot of media and a lot of photographers, and usually the photographer comes in, takes a few shots and leaves. And in this case, Gene came in, and we've been working together for the next 6 years. So it has been really amazing. And unlike a lot of people who come in as the photographer to add on to the story, Gene obviously took an enormous interest in this, obviously, deep personal interest in it. I had run across a writer by the name of Michael Weinrip, who writes for the New York Times, usually on local New York issues. He had done an extensive piece on the Steve Goldstein, I believe his name was, case, the guy who pushed someone in front of a subway in New York City and had covered mental health issues in New York. And so we were very impressed by what he had done in New York. And one of my board members who had done advocacy work in New York spoke to him, said, look, you know, what's going on all around the world is incredibly similar. A lot ways more extreme. If you go back 20 or 30 years to what was going on in Willowbrook and places like that, Again, strikingly similar, but whereas the United States has moved on, some of those horrendous conditions and institutions exist throughout the world. And Michael Weinrup took a great interest in it. So he got the New York Times Magazine to agree to do an in-depth piece. We were going down to do an investigation in Mexico, and all the arrangements had been with Michael Weinrup. And I heard after all the arrangements were made, indeed, that the New York Times had arranged for a photographer to come, and I met Gene in Mexico City right as we were about to head off to visit that institution. So that's how it got going.
So, Gene, they publish a story, mm-hmm. and you know it's the beginning of something that's going to be a bigger commitment on your part. So maybe you can give people a sense of what you knew at that point, what it felt like to be published to some degree, and then I know you're feeling that it's been a struggle since then to get the kind of exposure to the issue that the two of you have been working towards for that time since.
Well, I think the thing is anybody who's a photojournalist gets very pleased when something that you see and try to document gets used in this fashion. And most of us, a lot of the work we do is very disappointing. I can actually say that. Susan can attest probably more than most people. If you go out and you work your ass off to try to show something as it is, and then a magazine takes it and turns it into something that, you know, photographers today are going through that, as we know. Covering the war, for example, when you can do one kind of work and suddenly it comes out differently. And I know photographers suffered a great deal during the beginning of this war in that respect. Here was a case where I went down. I knew something. I had seen conditions around the world of people like this, but not extensively. And to meet people whose commitment, I understood. I didn't understand totally all the work that they did. But it was in depth. It wasn't coming in and going. It wasn't being with a reporter and coming and going. As wonderful as Michael was, and Michael is a wonderful reporter, I said, these people, I understand what they're doing, and they're not stopping. So I said, maybe I can grab a hold of something. Selfishly, I think, too, because not just because I really believed in it, but also I needed to believe in what I was doing, too. And suddenly I had someone that worked in both capacities, and to me it meant a lot, still does.
Yeah. Well, that just seems like a really important juncture point right there. Even in your own personal history, when I think back on the earliest work, which many of you all would know, based on Dorchester Days or Delta, this shift in being published effectively, whether it be Life or New York Times, about different issues you've addressed, and then suddenly making a shift towards what we're calling, or we're trying to understand, this notion of advocacy and really partnering and being more strategic to some degree together. So your recognition that you wanted to engage in a different way with a partner.
Well, I think it comes from another thing. When you're a photographer or a writer, I think in your early years, I think you're kind of almost self-focused in some ways. I mean, you're looking, you've got a personal view you want to put out, but suddenly you get to be an older person, and that's not enough. I mean, it isn't enough. It's enough you want the stuff to be used, because otherwise it gets to be this profoundly sweet-tempered ego trip. And when it's not used in that capacity, it's very exciting. It doesn't happen very often, I must say, for any of us. But when it does happen, it's great. That's all, you know. But I think the important thing here, and when we decided to have this kind of get-together, I felt there was also an opportunity, more importantly, to talk about the extent. When I look at these pictures, one thing that comes to mind when I looked at both places, and also since that time we went to Armenia, Kosovo, Eric's been in Turkey, is once you see these places, you've seen each one is in various degrees, but they're the same place, and that's a terrible thing to experience, and I think that's an important issue to discuss. The fact that I try to write it naively, that once you have been, someone puts a hand on and deduces that you're mentally disabled in some capacity, then you can do anything you want with them and treat them any way you want.
So Eric, I mean, you begin this organization, you know, I mean, maybe you can give us a sense of what you think you can, how you can be most effective through witnessing the photographs,
right.
But also what's the mission of the organization?
The organization I set up 12 years ago to bring international attention to human rights abuses against people with mental disabilities. It's a subject that's been essentially entirely overlooked by other international human rights organizations, you know, from Amnesty International to every other major international human rights organization. I mean, people tend to write off this population entirely. If you're a political dissident and you are locked up in a psychiatric hospital, then that's a human rights abuse because your free speech, your political activity is being inhibited. But it was deeply, deeply disturbing to me when I started this work and I looked at the record of what human rights groups had done, that they had very effectively documented every time a dissident got put in a psychiatric hospital. But if you look between the lines of their reports and even in some of the photographs, thousands and thousands of other people. I mean, if you look on a worldwide level, there are millions, half a million children alone in Russia, millions of adults with intellectual disabilities, mental retardation, mental illness around the world who are locked up, separated from society. Once they're in institutions, they are forgotten about totally. And to me, one of the reasons the whole human rights kind of methodology of exposing and shaming was so critical for this population is that every society seems to have an interest in not seeing what this population is like. They put them away. In many countries where we work, institutions are as remote and as far from population centers as humanly possible. I remember looking at a map of Hungary once. Budapest is in the middle, and if you look at where the institutions are, they're literally right at all the borders with all the other countries, so that you have to drive as many hours as possible. You know, is it the guilt of the families who feel bad about not visiting their relative who's been put away? Is it the fact that the government really doesn't want people to see how horrendous the conditions are? I think it's a complex combination of all those factors, but again, incredibly similar. So just the idea of exposure, of getting it out, getting people to know. People do not know what's going on in their own society behind those closed doors. Bring it to attention. I started to realize that we had to work with a photographer early on in the work that I was doing, again, in Hungary, which is one of the first countries that I worked in. We visited a social care home where we found adults literally locked up in cages. And I remember when we were going through this institution, and it was about 4:30 in the afternoon during the winter, so it was getting dark, so you couldn't see so much inside. So about 4:30 in the afternoon, the staff walked into a room, flicked on the light, and there were 16 people in cages in this one room. They all, the kind of eyes couldn't quite adjust to the bright light all of a sudden. These were beds with a metal frame over them and nets. They couldn't get up to go to the bathroom, so people were literally covered in their own feces. They had bed sores all over their bodies. And again, what shocked me was the staff person was completely nonchalant about it. You know, this is where we put our behavior problems, was the way she put it. The people who were locked up in these cages, you know, turned on the light, you know, let me look around for a few minutes, turned off the light, and ready to move on. There was one person screaming in the back of the room, and I didn't know whether it was comprehensible speech or whether they were saying anything. So I asked my assistant, who was Hungarian, and they said, they're screaming for water. It was just a horrifying sight for me. We came back, and we wrote a report about that. But at the time, it hadn't occurred to me to take photographs or video. In the abstraction, people locked in cages, I can tell you about it now, but when we did a human rights report about it, it was all an abstraction. And we realized we had to go to use media, we had to use photographs. And so it was in part, that was one of the reasons that we started reaching out to journalists who would also be able to bring that in. The Mexico case is a really very inspiring case. The New York Times Magazine article brought world attention to it. Television started piling on. We got television coverage. We got really blanketed coverage. And the government of Mexico was extremely embarrassed. Again, people often say, is a human rights approach useful if you're trying to bring about social change in a complex area like mental health? Is an oppositional approach going to work rather than providing them technical assistance, collaboration? They tried for years to keep us out of those institutions. They were hostile to us. They didn't want the world to see. But once the world saw, like that, they were able to make change. We went in with a psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Okun, who was chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General Hospital. After the publicity came out in the Mexico case, one of the television cameras put its nose in the face of the Minister of Health, who said, I'm ashamed. And they said, are you going to change things? And he says, I promise in 6 months there's going to be change. the government of Mexico called us up and said, okay, you've done your report. Now can you help us? We've just promised that in 6 months there's going to be change. We brought Dr. Okun from San Francisco General Hospital and 10 of his staff down to Mexico at that institution that you just saw. He literally stopped at the airport to pick up toilet paper so when he came, at least he could bring, there was no toilet paper, no towels, no nothing, got to the institution and found that the pipes were from over 100 years ago. There was no running water except for in that one area where you saw the showers. So there was no point in having toilet paper. People couldn't use the running water. The bathrooms didn't work anyway. And he recommended the institution could not be fixed up. It had to be leveled. And within 6 months, that institution was leveled. A third of the people in the institution were moved into community-based group homes in the area. They provided emergency services for them. A third of them were unfortunately moved to other institutions, and a third were still fighting there on the grounds of that facility and still working to get them integrated into the community. But I can tell you, the word got out, people saw, they were horrified, and change happened very quickly.
Well, I sort of want to kick this back to Gene because I'm thinking about, I mean, if the mission is shaming a government through exposure,
right,
and being effective in closures or adaptation, you know, where are you most frustrated as a photographer? Because I know that part of this has been, you know, I can feel it from you. But, you know, what you know, the ghetto we live in, we all understand the limits. You know, where else do you want these pictures to be as effective as you feel as a photographer they can be?
Susan knows me. I'm frustrated all the time. So.
Well, that's true, too.
Well, first, my problem, and Eric can attest, is I'm impatient and unrealistically at times because the work that he's talking about takes a lot. It isn't about photography at all. It's about legal movements. It's about examination. So I'm always ready to go next. I call up Eric, when are we going to go next? Because once you see one institution is, there's thousands of such places and millions of such people. So I get, that's my impatience. I think the struggle for us is in terms of the visuals and the message, and it's not the visuals, how do we get it out? So that's why we may have experimented with little videos. Is there a way to get that material out? We talked about doing a book, and the struggle of doing a book is that books are costly, and is it going to achieve something if we do a $40 book? Will that get out? One thing that would be made clear is that when Eric and his staff prepare a pamphlet like this, first off, it's presented within the country. It isn't presented, I think it's an important thing, it isn't presented in the United States with the embarrassment coming back, let's say, to Mexico. It's presented in the country, which I think is a very courageous thing to do. So it's a different way of using material. We're used to, you know, doing it from a magazine, and it leaks over, and everybody says, well, here comes America again slamming the rest of the world. But in this case, it's internal, and I think that's a big difference. And that's what also excites me, that you go there and the people there understand the nature of what they're seeing. And you're not just pointing the finger from this kind of pulpit that we live on in America. We're still exploring how you get the material out in terms of, we're talking about recently, I got a OSI, gives us a little chunk of money if I'm done with this project to prepare videos. And if we do this, we're thinking about how do you make them cheap enough DVDs so you can send them out by the hundreds of thousands to these human rights groups. There are all around the world. There are people working for these conditions, but they need tools. It's like we need tools. So this way, if we can get to the point where we can make things like this, ship them out there, then we're producing something. If we can make chapters of books, even these things cost too much for the purpose. So we're exploring now and talking all the time about how the hell do we get material out. The hope, as Susan knows, for all of us was, you know, online communication. But it still hasn't broken through to the point where people are really, where you can tell stories in a consistent level. We can get one or two out, but how do we tell them all the time? So we're open for suggestions. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do little films. Eric's doing these books. You do lectures. But we're trying to increasingly find cheap ways to get them out so that we can start sending them around to other places. So that's where we are. So if I get frustrated, you just know you're not doing enough. I mean, my frustration is you do something on Mexico, you do something, and then you turn your I should be in Africa or doing something. I should be in the Middle East. I should be in Asia. I should be in America doing these pieces. So, you know, that's the frustration.
Well, I frankly appreciate your frustration. You say you're impatient. And as far as I'm concerned, it makes what you do, not only what you do well as a photographer, but as an advocate. You know, once we learn to be patient about these human rights abuses, we should retire and no longer be advocates. We got to be pressing for pushing change as fast as possible and getting the word out as widely as possible. And sitting here, you know, I saw your video when you first made it, and it's been a couple of years since I had seen it. And, you know, we do use Gene's photographs in the kind of more traditional way that a human rights organization uses photo and video. Gene keeps saying, you know, we publish detailed human rights reports. They're in Spanish. They're in English. They're distributed. So, you know, the reports have his photographs in them. We've got brochures on our organization. All those traditional ways. But seeing that video and the power of that video, I think it goes one step beyond just, you know, helping to understand what's in the human rights report. But to me, the shift in mindset to understand what it means truly, the kind of humanity of the human beings, the people that are there, the very urgency that Gene talks about why he's frustrated doing this work, is the very same urgency that you need to feel and that you get when you see that video. So the fact that I haven't seen that video for 2 years is a sign to me of we haven't been doing a good enough job at getting that kind of material out. So there's a lot of different ways, and we really need to push the envelope more as to find new ways to do that.
Eric, I just wonder, going back to, this advocacy question mark, shaming governments, but then what about an audience like this? What are these people, how do they participate in this issue in a meaningful way? I mean, I guess my question is somewhat, and I do feel the DVD Gene has a much more personalized and subjective entry point for people to be, they're inside your skin in a different way than the series of photographs and hearing a man sing, and certainly a report. They're totally different objects of engagement, you know. So what's at most what either of you want from this audience, or as it expands out, if it's online or if it's on television or whatever, how do they participate in this issue?
Well, I mean, just two ways to answer your question. First of all, as an advocate, I find it is easiest to bring about kind of, for us to bring about change, we usually have to kind of harness public outrage. It's easiest to harness that outrage at what one of my board members called it stage one horrors versus stage two horrors. He may have been quoting someone, I don't know. In the case of Paraguay, we knew that two boys were held in these isolation cells naked for 4 to 6 years. That was a stage one horror. Just you see it, it's an outrage, it's got to change. And Gene's photograph of the guy, this is on our brochure, this is the photograph of the guy in the isolation cell. This guy is named Jorge. He's, when you get to know him, a really nice person. You'd never know from this shot. We brought a lawsuit in the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights against the government of Paraguay. They ordered something called precautionary measures, which are, under international human rights law, legal measures that you have to take quickly in severe life-threatening situations. And when we went, it was the first time ever that anyone had gone to this branch of the OAS to demand life-saving measures to protect the lives of a person in a psychiatric hospital. The OAS ordered these boys released from isolation cells. And again, we were able to bring very quick results. After the order was issued and we had given this photograph to the commission, one of the members of the commission walked out and said, "It was looking at this photograph that made me understand what exactly you were talking about." So it was absolutely clear that in terms of the stage one horror, the photograph helped describe the problem. But here's the irony of the advocacy process. If you've got people who are in institutions who are covered in their own shit, living in isolation cells, it's very easy at that institution to clean the place up, to whitewash the walls, to put in a bed, and unlock the cage, but let them out into the ward of the hospital. Those people can still sit in isolation. They can still be cut off from the community. They can have no activities. They can have no contact with their family, no opportunity to work. What happened in Paraguay was that the government did exactly that. They released the person from the isolation center, the isolation cell. They painted the walls of the institution against our advice. We said, don't bother. Get these people out. Don't waste your money. It's a poor country rebuilding this institution. And we sat there frustrated watching as they rebuilt this institution. So now these people are locked up and separated from society in a nice, pretty, clean institution. And again, as I was sitting there looking at those photographs, the horror that I was thinking about is the last hearing we had at the commission when the government of Paraguay came back and they used photographs to demonstrate how wonderful things were in the institution because there were nice clean walls and people were in nice clean beds with sheets on them now and how much they had improved things. So photography could be used to justify the status quo. Now what we've got to my mind is what we call a stage two horror. The stage two horror is the isolation from society. And that's where I feel like Jean's photos really go beyond just step one. That getting people out to change people's mindset, to make them understand it's not just enough to clean up the facility. And what Jean has done for us in a lot of places is gone back. In Kosovo, it was another case. The United Nations took over Kosovo. Against our advice, they rebuilt the facility. And Jean was able to take some pictures in the cleaned up facility and show what an incredibly depressing place it was, how absolutely isolating it was, how these people were completely dehumanized in a clean environment. And changing the way people think, I think, is absolutely essential, and that's what I really appreciate about my collaboration with them. In a way, it could have been Jean, it could have been someone else. The stage one horrors are ultimately the easier horrors to challenge, and in getting at the real humanity of the people and the underlying problems, that's where I feel videos like this that help us reach out to people. So whether it's people in the United States who have to work on U.S. policies, international development policies, the work of American social workers who donate their times to organizations, or working in countries to educate the social workers of Paraguay, World Health Organization agencies. I can tell you how many doctors and social workers work in the technical agencies and still don't get how horrible it is to live in a nice cleaned-up facility separated from society. So that's a lot of the way that we can use photography like this, is to get at that deeper understanding, change the way people think about mental illness and about what it means to be locked up in one of these facilities.